There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Once again, glad to have you here for some classic cardboard conversation. And this week, we're doing something that's kind of becoming an annual tradition. And when I first did it, I regretted not doing it sooner. It was one of those great ideas that at the time I didn't realize was a great idea. It took me about 3 years to go, oh, wait, that's actually a great idea. And that, of course, is taking a look at the new release of Topps Heritage and comparing it to the set that it was modeled after. And Topps has been doing the Heritage sets for over 20 years now. And finally, we're moving through the 1970s. The Heritage sets are out, or the Heritage packs, I should say, are out. And I'm not going to spend a ton of time talking about the Heritage sets. In fact, I'll be kind of complaining about the Heritage set, and it's all part of the booming business that is the baseball card industry these days. But we're going to be looking a lot at the set that it was based after. Like I said, like we've done the previous couple of years, and it is based off the 1972 Topps set. Now, in just a few minutes, we'll bring in Nick Deonte, who is a longtime friend of the program, and he has been our guest every year that we've had this particular topic. So I'm sure you're quite familiar with Nick if you're a follower of this podcast, or you just follow other podcasts or written articles about the industry or the sport. You're probably very familiar with Nick's work, as he is the voice and the keyboard tapper behind baseballhappenings.net. He's also a contributor to Forbes magazine and an influencer with the Topps Card Company. So we'll hear from Nick in a little bit. We'll talk a little bit about Heritage and the state of the business today. But let's talk a little bit about 72 Topps. And not that long ago, we did a podcast about the 1982 Topps Kmart 20th anniversary set, which is often joked about these days, much maligned because it was kind of the precursor to junk wax. Kmart and Topps had so many of these 44 card sets that were made back in 1982 that you can still find some in wrapped mint condition with stale bubblegum, and you could still get them pretty cheap. And even though we kind of make fun of that set because it's kind of like 88 Donruss, they're just still kind of sort of everywhere, there was a great purpose with the 82 Topps Kmart 20th anniversary set, and that is, of course, in the days before the internet and where information was at our fingertips, and certainly quite literally at our fingertips now with mobile phones. This was a great teaching tool for those who were new to the hobby, or maybe you couldn't afford that 62 Topps Mickey Mantle. At least you had the 82 Topps Kmart version of the 62 Topps Mickey Mantle, and you kind of had this knockoff card just to at least have something to refer to when you were talking about this particular set. And I remember when I was thumbing through the incomplete set that I had and still have, I remember seeing the 1972 Topps cards. And in particular, I saw the American League MVP for that year, the great, the late Dick Allen, who had just been traded from the Phillies to the South Side, to the Chicago White Sox. So you have a little bit of early 70s airbrush greatness, but you also have the pensive and interesting, eclectic character that was Dick Allen, just kind of, you know, staring down at the ground with the airbrushed red cap. Fortunately, Topps didn't have to airbrush too much because the White Sox had switched to white caps in 1971. And you had everything else that made 72 Tops what it is. And that, of course, is the colors, the team name at the top of the card kind of jumping out at you in a comic book kind of sans, a superhero kind of font. You didn't know what position Dick Allen played because for the first time in Topps baseball card history in 1972, they did not show the position that the player played on the front of the card. And then you had, his name down at the bottom. And, of course, with the 82 Topps Kmart cards, you didn't see the back of the 72 Topps cards. You only saw the front of each card. And here I am, I probably would have been 12 years old at the time. This would have been the late 1980s, a time in America that had its own challenges with colors and hairstyles and fashion and pop culture. It was a very loud part of the history of the country in the late 80s, heading into the early 90s. So here I am, a teenager, living, in the days of Tone Loke and Whitney Houston and, every other pop star at the time. Baggy clothes, colors everywhere. Everybody had some kind of hairspray or hair cream or hair gel in their hair when I had hair. So here I am in this context looking at this incredible card from 1972, and I'm thinking, wow, this is loud. This is, holy smokes, this is 1970s. And even in the late 1980s, there were still, 1972 was 5 years before I was born, so I can't honestly say, oh, I remember 1972. Well, I don't, because I wasn't there. But even in the late 1980s, there were still contextual clues in pop culture, be it television syndication, maybe re-releases of movies. And, there were still some things from the early 70s, even cars, some of these beasts that Detroit was still cranking out. They were still moving in the late 1980s, and I remember them fairly well. So I was able to look at this and go, wow, this is a whole lot of 1970s going on in this picture of this 1972 Topps card. And one thing that I vividly remember about that 72 Topps card, the Dick Allen card, was I immediately compared it to the board game Payday. Do you remember that game? I don't necessarily recall the purpose of that game. I remember playing it as a kid, and we had one of the original versions. I think the board game came out in like 1974 or 75. And you want to talk about color and loudness and comic book, typeface. You certainly got that in the mid-70s. But the board game Payday, which I think has since been re-released a few times. I don't know if it's been re-released in its 72 style. But or 75 style, like I said, whenever it originally came out. But I instantly put those two together. I'm like, yeah, this is 1970s, and there's a lot of 70s going on here. And as we will discuss briefly in our look back at 72 Topps, there's not only a lot of 70s going on in that set, but as we would discover over time, a lot of what we would see in baseball cards for what has now turned out over the next 49 years was in many ways birthed and approved of in 1972. And even if you're not a fan of super bright colors or the loudness or the style of the card itself, you have to appreciate that Topps really hit the nail on the head by creating a card that represented what life was like in 1972, but also some of the stars. There is one in particular, a key rookie in that set, and also some farewell cards. And there's a lot going on in 72 Topps where this is one of those sets where if you at first didn't really care much for it, maybe over time when you take a look back and you kind of see the whole set for what it is. And it was a huge set for what it was. At 787 cards, that was massive at that time. And keeping in mind, too, that Topps would eventually scale back down to 660 cards in the mid to late 70s. 787 cards was big and wouldn't be surpassed by Topps until the 1980s. But when you kind of look back at it and you see some of the ingenuity, you see some of the new things that came out of it while still putting its stamp on the look and feel of the times, I think 1972 Topps is one of those sets that is really underappreciated. And I don't mean this in kind of like, you know, an 88 Topps set, you know, where it had a hard act to follow with 87 Topps. And, you know, there is a little bit of that. You know, 71 Topps was such a work of art. You know, 72 was definitely a work of pop art. Definitely, you know, there's an Andy Warhol feel to what 72 Topps was. You know, I don't mean that kind of like, you know, oh, you know, I feel bad for this, or, you know, like I've got that soft spot for, you know, say 91 Bowman or, you know, some of the other sets that people quickly overlook. Now, I think this is one of those sets where because of the design, but also, you know, you do have the Carlton Fisk rookie, but, you know, it's not one of those sets like 75 where you've got Yount and Brett and so many others, you know, Gary Carter, and, you know, some of the second and third year cards of some of the big stars that came up through the 1970s. It's easily overlooked, which is hard to believe considering the style of the card because there's so much going on. It's hard to believe that it is easily overlooked, but I think it's one of those sets that I have over time kind of come back around to and go, yeah, this is, you know, I liked it before, but this is a lot better than I initially gave credit to. And I think you may be of that mindset as well. Now, before we bring in Nick, just want to let you know that our next program will be coming your way 2 weeks from now. That will be Friday, April the 9th. And we will be taking a look at our foodstuff cards. We've got all sorts of interesting co-branded cards with restaurants, with food products. They were really big in two particular time periods, in the late 70s and early 80s. Those are when the bigger deals were done. And of course, you pretty much only had Topps at that time producing these cards. But then it blew up again in the 1990s, where with the baseball cards being as popular as they were back then, everybody had to get their act in the baseball card game. So everybody was producing some sort of card, including restaurants and food products. So we'll talk about that in our next podcast. And again, thanks to a lot of cardboard donations from various listeners to help me, not have to buy as many of these products myself, but B, to really provide an interesting variety of these cards. So I'm looking forward to that on Friday, April the 11th. Now, what do we look at afterwards? We will see. We'll do some shopping on eBay. Perhaps I'll be able to head out to a store and pick up some products as well. And of course, we gladly take your suggestions at our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. Now, speaking of the Twitter timeline, if you click on the Wax and Gum Stains profile, you will see a link to a SurveyMonkey survey. And it's a very short survey. It's only 5 questions, takes you maybe a minute to fill out. And in fact, it's all, you know, multiple choice. You know, there's no essay on here. You know, unlike Chevy Chase performing the role of Gerald Ford, I can promise you there is no math involved in this. But if you can, please take a minute, click on that link, take a minute to answer the questions. That survey is designed to help me design the upcoming website, which will be waxandgumstains.com. Now, I want to thank those of you who have already done the survey. And to be honest, I could probably thank you with most of the digits on both of my hands. We haven't had quite the response to it yet. So that's why I put it in our Twitter bio. I'll send out a few more links to it as well. But over the next few weeks, if you get the chance, please fill out that survey because I do want to get the Wax and Gum Stains website right. I want it to be something that you look forward to, and it's something that complements this podcast, because while I enjoy doing the podcast, you know, because of everything else I'm balancing in my life, this is something that I can only really fully dive into according to our schedule, which is every other Friday. But for those downtimes where I can talk about products outside of baseball cards or, you know, dive into a little deeper on certain card stories or even card collectors, this is the place that's going to be done. And I certainly appreciate your feedback, not just about the website, but also about the show in general. Just a couple of things that I'm thinking about the show, I just want to confirm with you. And despite not getting a ton of responses yet, I have certainly received some great feedback. And yes, I have confirmed some of my suspicions so far and what you think about the show. Notably, it's a little too long, and that's okay. We're going to be making those adjustments. Again, a lot of these subtle adjustments over the next few weeks to deliver a show that kind of gets back to, you know, what we were looking to accomplish when we started this back in 2016, you know, these nice, short, snappy, entertaining programs, but also to branch out a little bit to what started with the big old monster box has turned into a monster of a program, and we want to keep it going, not just with the podcast, but also with this second, platform, basically, waxandgumstains.com. So might be a couple months as we build this out. I've got a lot going on in my life, good stuff. But, you know, obviously, I want to make sure that if I'm going to put in the time to build out this site and continue to improve the show, that we're actually hitting on what you, the listener, you, the fan, wants. So again, check out Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Click on the profile. You'll see the link there. You'll even see the link on our YouTube channel. And again, I've moved the YouTube videos. So if you subscribe to the YouTube channel, say 2 or 3 months ago, unsubscribe that. That's just my personal Gmail account. Just kick that out and subscribe to the new YouTube channel, which is appropriately named Wax Ecstatic. And our new email address is waxandgumstains@gmail.com. So that's one of the good things about this website too. A lot of the stuff that I go through, you know, upcoming programs, how to make donations, how to email us, a lot of that will be covered on the website. So we're talking less about it on the podcast, and we're talking more about some of the stuff that you want to listen to, including our look at 2021 Topps Heritage, which, as I mentioned before, is mirrored after the 1972 Topps set. We'll talk about the 72 Topps set in a moment, but without further ado, let's bring in a longtime friend of the program. He is not quite at the five-timer status, which, if you've watched Saturday Night Live, say 30 or so years ago, that was the joking status of Steve Martin and Tom Hanks and, you know, several other hosts. You know, once you hosted five times, you got the red carpet treatment and you got a nice bathrobe and things like that. We have no bathrobes or red carpets here. So, and he's also not at five times. I believe this is three. We are pleased to bring into the program, again, a good friend of the program here, the voice and the writer behind baseballhappenings.net, Forbes magazine contributor, Topps influencer, Nick Deonte. Nick, thank you so much for joining us here on Wax Ecstatic.
Matt, I always enjoy coming on the program, and our annual talk signals that baseball is back.
Yeah, it's almost like a bat signal that's going out here. And it's so funny, when I was setting this up, I was kind of looking through our texting and messaging history. And it was, believe it or not, a year and a day ago, Nick, that we had our last chat. And what a difference a year and a day makes, because the last time we were talking, now you're in the New York City area, which of course was pretty much ground zero for COVID a year and a day ago, and things are shutting down, and you know, the regular season in baseball is getting postponed, and nobody's really knowing what's going on. You know, granted, we're not totally out of the woods with COVID yet, but it's just amazing how much has changed. But with that said, if there's one positive thing to come out of all of this, it's that there's a little bit of love for the baseball card industry. Once again, people all cooped up and bored, looking for something to do. Well, they found it going through their stacks of wax. So what are your thoughts about just what the hobby's been through in the last year, in what has been a pretty much abnormal year in every other measurement, has just been such a positive boom for the most part in card collecting?
It has been incredible, and it's something that I did not expect to happen. You know, we would talk a lot about, you know, junk wax, and you're always talking about, you know, buying boxes for a few bucks here, a few bucks there, and you know, who knew that within the span of a year that attention would turn to those boxes that you would find piled up at shows, you know, and you mentioned on your show quite often. So it's really been incredible to see the way that it's taken off and the interest and the spike in interest. And then modern cards becoming scarce for, you know, reasons that we never thought. You never thought you would see people camping out for cards. But it's happened, and, you know, here we are, and there are a lot of people who got back into it and are talking about it, and maybe it's a little cooler than it was a year ago. So it's been exciting to see all of that happen.
Yeah, a lot of it not only has to deal with people being locked up with COVID and just trying to find something to do and reconnecting with their passions, but, you know, a lot of it, too, is 90s nostalgia, as we've brought up. You know, the people who are our ages suddenly want to go back, throw it back 30 years and feel good about everything once again. So that's the good thing, and you're right. Boy, the days of, you know, waiting for the new releases to come out and then you can't find it anywhere because it's such a hot commodity. Now, that's a good thing in the sense that, you know, we're not producing cards by the billions once again, and, you know, there is actual value to some of these newer products. But, Nick, is there a little bit of a downside to the fact that if you just want to grab a couple packs or maybe a box at your local Walmart or Target, man, you've got to go cross country to get some of these things here. There's goodness about scarcity, but at the same time, do you think that there's a little bit of a downside, like, wait, we're kind of shorting ourselves here a little bit. There's got to be a nice little balance here.
I think about the kids, right? I think the adults will be okay if they can't pick up cards. But I think about the kids, and I had a friend lament to me that he said, you know what I'm frustrated about? Not that I can't open the cards, but I can't take, like, my 12-year-old son, who's a baseball fanatic, to Target or Walmart and pick up cards. He's like, I should be able to walk in the store and get some 2021 tops with ease. And when I can't, that's a problem. And so that's what I'm seeing, is that, you know, we need kids to prolong the hobby, for them to be interested in cards. And when you start raising the prices and making them scarce, they're just going to go to whatever else is available, because it's going to be the rare kid that's going to really be like, mommy or daddy, you know, I want to pay, you know, $60 for a blaster box when it's really $20. Like, you're not going to get that many kids that are into it. So that's what my bigger concern is, the kids. And then the other part is the bubble, right?
Yep.
This so reminds me of the 90s, when everyone did get into collecting, and they were collecting because it's hot and because you can make money, right? All these themes, I'm sure, were eerily familiar to you and that we continue to see online. And that just signals to me it is getting a little too hot. And at some point, the weekends are going to fold, and we are going to be left again with a proverbial house of cards.
Yeah, and hopefully, again, because of much smaller production numbers, when that bubble pops, and it will, there's less of a fallout than what we saw 25, 30 years ago. But you're right about, you know, the kids. Like, I wanted to just buy a few packs to open with my son, and that was, you know, an effort to find that. Like, I had to go to Walmart at the right time. There are more card shops in my area, but still kind of limited. You got to travel a little bit to find them. And I like, you know, I coach Little League. I like at the end of each season to give the kids on our team, you know, a pack of cards kind of as a thank you. And, you know, of course, to get them involved in the hobby too. And I'll be honest, Nick, I had to buy an extra retail box just to store it away. You know, the season's not over for another 3 months, but I had to store it away because I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to find this summer. So there's, you know, there is that shortness and shortage of the product out there. Again, good for investing, good for chasing. There's a little bit of a thrill in the collecting, but you don't want to, you know, what's the old saying, cut your nose off to spite your face. Nick Deontay joining us here on Wax Ecstatic. Now, Nick, before we talk about some of the newer Topps products that you've had a chance to ogle over the last few weeks, let's throw it back to 1972. That's the set that the Topps Heritage release this year is based on. I love the 1971 Topps set, hence last year's Heritage set, because there's so many classic elements to that 71 set. But 72 Topps, so many things happening in that set. When you think 72 Topps, if somebody says, Nick, give me one word for 72 Topps, what's that word, that first thought that you think of when you think of that set?
It's colorful.
You got that
right.
I like
the colors. I like the colors in the 72 tops, especially as contrasted to the 71 set.
Yeah, and the color is not only vibrant, as many colors were in the early 70s. That's when, you know, a lot of teams started wearing the powder blues or various different colors on the roads. But jumping out at you, too, that kind of comic book Superman font. Yeah, there's a whole lot of 70s happening in that 72 set. So, you know, there's a lot to like about that. What are some other things that stand out about that 72 set every time you get a chance to, you know, grab a handful of those cards and just kind of comb through them?
Sure. The Clemente card obviously stands out because, right, I think that was his last issue. So there's a really iconic card there in that 72 set. But also the boyhood cards, mm-hmm. right? So I thought those were really fun to see, and I've had a few of those signed over the years by, you know, players when they were kids. And then the in-action card, right? I think those are also a nice touch. So between those two kind of subsets within the set, plus, you know, you have Roberto Clemente's last card, Carlton Fisk's rookie, it's a really nice and fun set to look at because of those, you know, variations in there.
Yeah, and we'll discuss a little more about the 72 set later on in this program. And, of course, you know, the when they were childhood stars, you know, Jim Fregosi playing an accordion. I mean, who would have thought, you know, that's, you know, you're thinking Jim Fregosi playing Little League or Jim Fregosi at the swimming pool or whatever. No, here he is with this ginormous accordion. And there are some other fun pictures there, too. But, of course, the in-action kind of subsets, that would set a trend for more action shots as opposed to the old pose shots there. Not a lot to dislike about 72 tops, unless you don't like color, and some people don't. Now, that's the base of the Topps Heritage set. Now, Nick, you've been an influencer for the Topps company for a while. You get some advanced product every now and then. You get to check things out and share it with everybody, you know, before it hits store shelves in some cases. But what have you seen so far this year? What's coming down the pike that you think even collectors who focus on, say, junk wax or some vintage wax, which we mostly talk about on this show, you need to have a look-see at some of this current stuff?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's been a little slower because Topps had some issues with pressing and their employees really not being in their Brooklyn office. So I think they held off on a lot of promo for 2020. So I didn't get the full boat of what I normally get. But, you know, I sat down with the flagship, and I enjoyed it, and I wrote a piece for Forbes just about how it captured playing baseball in a pandemic. And I think people, you know, need to take a hard look at that 2021 Topps Series 1 because it really did capture a landmark season. You know, when do you think you would see baseball players with masks on baseball cards and, you know, pouring hand sanitizer on and, you know, elbowing each other or coming close to a high five? I think they got it right with the Series 1 flagship of telling an unprecedented baseball story in the game's history.
And, of course, we'll all be eagerly awaiting with what should be a relatively normal Major League season. Even fans in the stands in most cases, that'll mm-hmm. be an interesting adjustment. You know, we're eagerly awaiting, too, the rollout of all of the normal brands. I've already seen promos from Topps for, you know, the Bowman cards, and you know that those will be snapped up quickly, especially those that love the
yeah.
prospects. But you mentioned the Forbes article you recently wrote. Let's get everybody up to speed on what you've been doing recently. Tell us about some of the Forbes cards and you know, some of the podcasts and interviews, things that you've been up to in the last couple months.
Well, you know, I just finished a piece on Mike Trout today. I spoke with the Angels dietitian, Becky Twombly, about, you know, what she's doing to help keep their $400 million plus man on the field.
No pressure.
Their whole nutrition program. Yeah, right? And their whole nutrition program that they run for the whole team. And, you know, she told me about working with Albert Pujols and how those guys kind of set the tone for everybody else to follow the program. And, you know, people often think about getting ballplayers in shape and they just think about hitting the weight room. And they really have a coordinated effort.
Well, Nick, as we wrap up here, tell people how they can find you and some things to look forward from you over the next few weeks.
Sure. And again, Matt, I always enjoy coming on. And check my website, baseballhappenings.net. My column with Forbes is linked there really on all of my my sights. And, you know, I look forward to really catching up on more of what develops in the hobby going forward. And the month of April, I'm going to have a lot of interviews coming up with a lot of baseball authors, because with the start of the season, there's a lot of baseball books coming out. And so hopefully I have some great stories that I help can enhance, because there are a lot of baseball books out there. And, you know, it'll keep everybody busy during the season if you want something, you know, supplemental to read while you're watching the game.
Well, Nick Deonte, thank you so much again for joining us here on Wax Ecstatic. Always a pleasure to catch up, and certainly looking forward to seeing your work here over the next few months.
Thank you, Matt.
All right, my thanks again to Nick Deonte. You can follow him on Twitter at Examine Baseball. That's all one word. Again, the website is baseballhappenings.net. And if you follow him on Twitter, he obviously links out some of the stories that he's working on for various publications, but he is a frequent contributor to Forbes magazine. Recently put out a story about how the Angels are keeping Mike Trout healthy. It is a rather big and expensive contract, so you definitely want to make sure that, you know, if you're the Angels, you're taking care of your marquee player, since he is taking up a chunk of your payroll. And he's also got a lot of other great stories. You could just stroll through his timeline, or scroll through it too. Stroll if you want to get your steps in, but scroll through his timeline, and you will see a lot of the fine work that Nick does. And, you know, give him a follow on baseballhappenings.net. He puts out occasional Zoom interviews, podcasts as well, a lot of really fun stuff. And I want to throw in, too, you know, the interview that I did with Nick when we recorded it. How did it run? Like 14, 15 minutes, something like that. And afterwards, Nick and I just kept talking and talking and talking and talking about everything under the sun. And in fact, we actually talked for probably about an hour and a half afterwards, which leads me to this observation I made years ago when I started out my broadcasting career as a talk show host and producer. And that is, the best talk show is the off-air show. Now, we used to joke at the radio stations that I worked at, the off-air show was when a listener would call in, typically for a talk show, and a listener would call in but wouldn't actually want to go on the air with the host. So he or she would instead chew the ear off of the producer who had to answer the phone. And it was normally pretty divisive. You know, you'd pick up the phone and say, you know, hello, station WXYZ. You tell that moron that he's absolutely wrong about the Yankees this year. And it's just, you know, you had to try to be polite, but at the same time, you're rolling your eyes going, okay, I got work to do. But that was the off-air show. And anyone who's ever worked in broadcasting, you know that the off-air show is always the best show in so many ways. Now let's keep this show rolling here with our look back at 1972 Tops. As I mentioned, 787 cards, which by then was just a behemoth in the industry, and Tops would eventually scale back down to 660 cards and then move back up to 792 starting in the early 80s. But what made 72 Tops so special was, much like Major League Baseball was doing at the time, Tops was experimenting. Not that they had a poor product beforehand, but they just wanted to make things a little more exciting and a little more in line with the times. And as much as I really don't like how Rob Manfred and Major League Baseball have tinkered with things in recent years, and maybe it's not necessarily the tinkering, but it's the reasons for the tinkering that they at least give out publicly, much was going on at the same time in the early 1970s. And in fact, even into the late 60s, Bowie Kuhn, then the commissioner of Major League Baseball, testing several things, including the designated hitter. And in fact, I was reminded that the designated hitter was something that, you know, Major League Baseball didn't just come up with one day. I'm rereading Jim Bouton's Ball 4 right now, and he mentions how spring training 1969, as an American League team, the Seattle Pilots, they were experimenting with the designated hitter. And I think at the time it was, you know, not the designated hitter, but it was kind of seen as a full-time pinch hitter. That was the definition of it. And it's just a reminder that this was one of those things that took 4 or 5 years to kind of firmly develop into what became the designated hitter in 1973. But what's interesting is while Major League Baseball was doing some experiments, so was Topps, and not just in the size of the set. First of all, how the set was distributed. Instead of sending it out in 7 series, and we've talked about in past shows how the higher series, typically series 5, 6, and 7 of any given year, those are harder to track down and certainly in good condition because fewer of those cards were sold. And in some cases, fewer of those cards were printed. And that's simply because Series 5, 6, and 7 every year would roll out in June, July, August. People are, moving on to football. They're getting back to school. And for retailers, if they weren't successful enough in selling Series 1 through 4 before, well, now, you know, Series 5, 6, and 7... they're not going to buy it. So, you know, Topps never wanted to have a backlog of this material in their warehouses. So they either printed less or they would just get rid of it somehow. You would find, some older, higher series cards in, fun packs and stuff like that, just any way that Topps could move it out. So Topps tried to combat this in 1972 by not reducing the size of the set, but by reducing the size of the series. So only 6 series were created in the 72 Topps set. Now, what this means, too, is the Topps series, again, series 5 and 6, were still, in higher demand all these years later because fewer people bought them. There is some argument that Topps produced less of them because, again, they didn't want a backlog of these cards just, stocking up shelves in their warehouse. So if you're looking for, cards in the 500, 600, 700 number range for 72 Topps, you do need to go digging around a little bit. And, don't be surprised if you have to pay a little more for even a quote-unquote common card. That's just how things are right now. But you can still get your hands on a lot of 72 Topps cards. I've even seen some collectors do set breaks. And, some of these cards are just in outstanding condition as they come out. And you get to see some of the innovation that Topps was playing around with at the time. Never mind just the gaudy design of it. And that's actually how I think I learned about the definition, the word gaudy. I want to say it was in a book that Sports Collectors Digest made back, 30 or so years ago. They called 72 Topps gaudy, and they're right, by the way. It's not just the design, and the back of the card is kind of dull. It's kind of this, dark orange with black print on the gray cardstock. It's a little hard to read in some cases. But, it's not just the design, but it's what Topps did with that colorful design. It really helped showcase some of the stars of the game. It kind of almost made them look like they were on movie posters, or like I said before, almost like the cover of a comic book. So if you're pulling a Pete Rose out of a pack, or Nolan Ryan, who of course wasn't yet a star, as evidenced by his airbrushed California Angels hat on top of his New York Mets pinstripe shirt, you still saw these ball players kind of presented as superheroes, and it was kind of neat. You saw the final cards with current teams for stars such as Willie Mays. It would be his final baseball card with the San Francisco Giants. He had been traded to the New York Mets just weeks before. You would also see the last card for Frank Robinson with the Baltimore Orioles. He had been traded to the Dodgers. And sadly, the last cards for Roberto Clemente, talking about looking somber, kind of looking down. I should say last card of him, in life. And it's kind of a very reflective picture of him. But also for Gil Hodges, the manager of the New York Mets, who tragically passed away during spring training 1972. And in fact, the OPC version of the Gil Hodges card for 1972 actually mentions that he had passed away, kind of a little in memoriam tag on the front of the card. As we mentioned in our previous show, 72 Topps also featured the debut of the traded cards Strangely, Willie Mays, not one of those players noted as being traded. However, Frank Robinson was one of them. I also mentioned Steve Carlton, Jim Fregosi, who was the other guy going in the other direction in the Nolan Ryan trade. And that was a pretty neat, groundbreaking moment there. As I mentioned in the past show, too, Topps would every other year do some traded cards, with the exception of the late 70s, and then finally it became a permanent piece to the base set, or a permanent addition with the base set starting in 1981. But speaking of a guy like Jim Fregosi, he was a player who was featured in the When They Were Young subset, which is very neat in 1972. Again, remember, pre-internet, and we're talking 20 years before the internet. So, you know, now if you want to look up childhood photos of Major League ball players, it's just so easy to do. Just type in their name in Google and, you know, maybe childhood picture or Little League or something like that, and you'll find that picture. But in 1972, this was a unique way of Topps introducing these players in a personal storytelling. And Jim Fregosi was one. And as I mentioned with Nick Deonte, having Jim Fregosi and a childhood picture of him playing a huge accordion was very entertaining. And there are some other examples, which I showed in our video review of 72 Topps on our YouTube page. And it's kind of neat. And again, if you kind of put yourself in the context of 1972, you probably had no idea what your favorite ball players did as a child. And it certainly wouldn't have been easy to access any kind of photographic history of it. So this was a very neat way of kind of pulling the curtain back a little bit on some of these ball players. Now, the biggest factor of the 1972 Topps set, the biggest innovation that would completely change how baseball cards were made and how they're still made today, is the action shot. Now, in 1972, Topps decided to, what we in the marketing and broadcasting business call billboard. And when you billboard something, that's, you know, when you're blatantly telling everybody, hey, here it is. And in 72, the action shots were kind of a subset to the base set. I mean, they were part of the base set, but they were little additional cards, much like the traded cards were. And it would say in action, and it would show the player in action, much like the traded cards, where you could, you know, certainly in 74 and 76, you could slide the traded card next to the base card, you know, the first release of the card. So you have both of the player's cards back to back if you chose. That's what Topps did in 1972 with the in action cards. So, for example, Billy Williams, Chicago Cubs legend, card number 439. The next card, Billy Williams in action, card number 440. Now, the in action cards were interesting on the backs because that varied what was on the back of the cards. And I again showed you some examples in our YouTube video. So the Billy Williams is a great example where if you flip the in action card over, is it anything about Billy Williams? No, it's kind of a news recap story of J.R. Richards' major league debut, which was an impressive one, a 15 strikeout shutout performance of the San Francisco Giants. But J.R. Richard of the Houston Astros and the San Francisco Giants as the opponent really have very little in common with Billy Williams. So you had that situation. Other cards had some baseball trivia on the back. Others had promotional announcements for what you could find in other packs of 72 Topps. And then some, and we've seen this in previous years, Topps did this often in the mid to late 60s into the early 70s, especially with the Sporting News All-Star cards. If you flip the card over, it formed a piece of a puzzle. So if you collected enough of these cards, you would have kind of this, you know, large puzzle made up of 10 or 12 cards on the back. And some of the in action cards I have featuring a 1971 National League MVP Joe Torre of the St. Louis Cardinals. So some interesting combinations and content choices on the backs of these cards. But really, the big news is what was on the front there. Topps had experimented with some action photos in the 1971 set. By 1973, they would go all out crazy with action shots, a little too crazy, as their desire to show action could not be met by the limited technology, super zoom lenses, and photographer access down on the field was still very limited in the early 70s. So you would often get these very wide angle shots, not featuring one player in action, but five or six guys involved in a play. And especially in 73 and 74 tops, it was kind of hard to figure out, well, who the hell are we talking about? Wait a minute, which player here is, this player that's listed on the card? And you had to kind of do a little detective work there. But it was a momentous change here, because nowadays you have some posed shots, some headshots that are still used on baseball cards. But for the most part, I'd say probably 85-90% of the photos on the front of the cards are action shots. And you would expect nothing less. And again, pre-internet and really pre-cable television in many cases, this was an eye-opener for baseball fans who, if you didn't live in, say, Detroit, you couldn't see a guy like, Al Kaline in action. If you didn't live in New York City, you couldn't see Cleon Jones in action. You couldn't see Billy Williams in action if you weren't in Chicago, or if you didn't live in a major league city where the Cubs or the Mets or the Tigers would come in as a visitor. So again, contextual clues here, because we kind of look at it and it seems so innocent and naive. Oh, they're in action. This was kind of a big deal back in the day, where you didn't have those options to see these players, be it in person or on television. The closest you got to it, publications such as Sports Illustrated or the Sporting News, Baseball News, etc., or baseball cards. That was pretty much it. So Topps was able to deliver, even in the clunky technological terms of the time. Topps was able to deliver the action of the game in cardboard form, and that is something that would continue and still continues to this day to be the focal point of the front of a Major League Baseball card. Now, the game was changing a lot. Topps had to change too, and as we would see throughout the 1970s, things that were affecting Major League Baseball would affect Topps and baseball cards as well, including litigation, Major League Baseball dealing with the Players Association. In fact, 1972, the first year that the players went on strike, delayed the start of the 72 season by a couple of weeks. So you had that. but Topps, of course, would start litigation with Fleer in 1974, and that would drag out for several years. You also had the designated hitter. In fact, that's one of our random selections here, Ron Bloomberg, part of our bottom third, which we'll get to, or bottom of the order, which we'll get to in just a moment. So you've got the designated hitter that finally takes place in 1973. And you also had more players on the move. Those traded cards that I was talking about, a whole lot more airbrushing going on, including the entire Washington Senators team, which had moved to Texas and became the Texas Rangers in 1972. You had a lot of refabricated or refurbished baseball photos, including Dick Allen. And, that's because players were on the move, as players were either seen as costing too much or had personality problems. They didn't quite fit in, with the structure or the chemistry of a team. Prior to free agency, the only way that teams would be able to try to get something in return for these players was to send them elsewhere. So a lot of the things that you saw cropping up in the 70s, and that would also include having to deal with a tough economy, having to, change how you were doing things. Topps certainly had to do that through the mid-70s. What baseball was going through, what America was going through, Topps was going through as well. And you do see that reflected in the 1972 set. Now, in addition to the traded cards, the in-action cards, you also have some trophy cards. So if you ever wanted a card featuring a picture of the Cy Young plaque, well, there it is. You can find it in 72 Tops. And that's not unusual. They were actually doing the same thing with their hockey sets, I recall, in the 71-72 Tops and OPG sets. If you ever wanted a card of the Lady Byng Trophy, well, that's how you got it. So a little unusual, but kind of neat too, to get the hardware cards, if you will. And also throughout this set, you've got some major star players. I mentioned a few of them, but also the big rookie is Carlton Fisk. And of course, Carlton Fisk was that rookie card was featured in our Andrew Ridgely show about a year and a half ago, the multiplayer rookie cards, as he shares his rookie card with Cecil Cooper, as well as Mike Garman. And as I mentioned in the video, you certainly know Carlton Fisk. Chances are you know about Cecil Cooper, but Mike Garman is the Andrew Ridgely there. You're not exactly sure who he is, but he is certainly ridden the tales of Cecil Cooper and Carlton Fisk in baseball card history. And of course, the history is littered with a lot of those. So 72 Tops, again, is one of those card sets. It's loud. It's colorful. You heard Nick Diente say, color, you know, it jumps out at you. Quite literally, because of that comic book and superhero style, that movie poster style, it kind of has that 3D effect. It's coming for you. You can't miss it. But because it is sometimes a little too loud, it's not the subtle work of art like 71 Tops, or you could argue 70 Tops is, because it's not a little more conservative as, say, 73 or 74. Or, you know, there are some other more colorful sets, 75 in particular, but also you could argue 76. It kind of gets lost in the shuffle in some of the great sets of the 1970s. But I think now with the Heritage set kind of reviving the look and feel of the original 1972 Topps set, I think you're going to really, really like looking back at that set. And, you know, something Nick and I talked about here, you know, the business is booming, and I wish I actually had my hands on some Heritage cards, but I don't. So when I do get them, I will share you my thoughts about them. But as of this moment, I don't have it. I'll be honest, I'm not a huge fan of the 21 base set. I'm not. It's, you know, they've had better. But certainly we hope that there is no massive bubble burst, and we certainly hope that we don't lose kids, or we don't lose kind of the fringe customers who are buying these cards, because the hoarding of the cards, just the market that is the baseball card industry right now, is getting a little out of control, and it is concerning. And Nick was actually telling me in the off-air show that the initial run of Topps opening day sold out from the Topps website in 2 days. Now, nothing against Topps opening day, but if I had to, you know, rank my favorite Topps slash Bowman slash Allen and Ginter, you know, products, Topps opening day is maybe 6 or 7 on the list. You know, if that's the only thing on the shelf at the store, I don't really feel compelled to buy it. So, you know, if you've got the kind of mid to low tier cards flying off the warehouse shelves as quickly as they are, it's good for the industry, certainly good for Topps. They're going to make their money, but going to be interesting to see how the rest of the hobby deals with that. But I guess that's part of the new growth of the cards and the hobby and the business and the new growth in the game as well. Now let's go to the bottom of the order here, a quick look at three random selections. And what's funny about these random selections, and I picked them from the 8 or 9 pages of cards I showed on our video review, they are all actually tied into one another. So yes, they're random in the sense that, you know, I grabbed a few here and there, but one actually leads nicely into the other. And let's talk about the guy who was behind one of the innovations of the game at the time, Ron Bloomberg, the first designated hitter in Major League history. Ronald Mark Bloomberg, also known as the Boomer, a native of Atlanta, Georgia, And his family hails back to Romania. He is Jewish and is one of the most well-known Jewish ball players. Of course, you got Sandy Koufax in there too, but Bloomberg still, you know, through public speaking and through charitable events, very big on telling the story and supporting Jewish causes and the faith as well. Now, he was a huge star in high school, playing at Druid Hills High School, which is just outside of Atlanta, Georgia. He earned letters not only in baseball, but also track and field, football, and basketball. Now, when he was graduating from high school in 1967, Parade Magazine, that's one of those little inserts that you get in the Sunday newspaper, he was selected as an All-American for football, basketball, and baseball. And believe it or not, he is the only person ever chosen for all three teams by Parade Magazine. This is mind-blowing, all right? Now, we know Ron Bloomberg as a decent hitter who has this unique footnote in baseball history, but he had over 100 football scholarships and over 125 basketball scholarships. In fact, the legendary John Wooden, the head coach of UCLA, and remember, UCLA was just in the heart of its dynasty at this time, came out to meet Bloomberg and tried to recruit him. That's something, when John Wooden's coming to your living room, you're doing something well. But money talks. And when the pinstripes come your way, you're going to lean towards baseball. He was selected as the first overall pick in the 1967 amateur draft by the Yankees, who were definitely hitting rock bottom at that time. Signed for $75,000. And after finishing up some junior college near Atlanta, he would go on to play and study at Fairleigh Dickinson University, or as a former coworker of mine used to call it, Fairleigh Ridiculous University. Now, he would move up through the Yankee farm system from 1967 through 1971, getting some cups of coffee here and there, making his major league debut in September 1969. And after dealing a lot with injuries throughout the next couple of seasons, he would start settling in as a pretty productive hitter and decent outfielder as well. The problem for Ron Bloomberg is the manager, Ralph Houk, who preferred to platoon Bloomberg. So even though he was a productive hitter, he never consistently got into the lineup as an outfielder. So he was ripe to become the first designated hitter in the history of Major League Baseball. Now, this happens on April 6, 1973. And what should be noted about this particular game is that Ron Bloomberg almost did not become the first designated hitter in Major League history. Thankfully, for Ron Bloomberg and the New York Yankees, the rivals that they were playing that day, the Boston Red Sox in Boston, opening day 1973, were equally just as bad as the Yankees at this time. Both teams were definitely rebuilding for what would become a pretty entertaining American League East later on in the 1970s. But at the start of the game, Bloomberg was penciled in as the number six hitter. And meanwhile, for the Boston Red Sox, their designated hitter, the number five hitter in the lineup, I believe, was the terrifying Orlando Cepeda. So you would think, well, Cepeda at number five, I mean, look at the lineup. You got Aparicio, you've got Yaz, you've got Reggie Smith. Surely, you know, Cepeda is going to get to the plate before Ron Bloomberg does. Well, that doesn't happen. As Horace Clark gets a single to lead the game off, Roy White grounds into a double play. So base is empty, two outs. You're thinking, oh, well, this is it. Well, Matty Alou gets a double. Bobby Mercer walks. And then Greg Nettles walks. And what do you know? Ron Bloomberg, facing Louis Tiant, becomes the first designated hitter in Major League history. And he draws a walk as well, and with a sacrifice, a double to right field, Felipe Alou would knock in a couple of runs, and Bloomberg would advance but not score, as his good friend Thurman Munson would become the third out of the inning. So that is how Ron Bloomberg became the first designated hitter in Major League history. He had the good fortune of Louis Tiant losing a little bit of his control with two outs on the scoreboard. And also, as the visiting team with the first game of the regular season underway, or at least the first game of the American League underway, on April 6, 1973, at Fenway Park, he was able to be part of that. Now, the Red Sox would go on to pummel the Yankees 15-5, but Ron Bloomberg would get his bat from that day sent to the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. Now, he would continue to play for the Yankees for several more years, again, battling not only injuries, but also Ralph Houk and how he managed games. And, of course, later than Ralph Houk, you had Billy Martin and a slew of managers for the next few years. Only appearing in one game in 1976, missing all of 1977 with an injury that he sustained in spring training. And after the 1977 season, the Yankees cut him. The Chicago White Sox, who then at that time were in the business mode under Bill Veeck of signing aging veterans for one-year contracts and typically spinning them off the trade deadline, that's what they did with Bloomberg in 1978, at the age of 29, signs a one-year deal with the White Sox, has a rather pedestrian 231 season, appearing in just 61 games. And at the age of 30, his pro career was done. Now, Ron Bloomberg does do a lot of speaking engagements, like I mentioned. If you go to ronbloombergyankees.com, you will see the services that Ron Bloomberg now provides at a fee, of course. But the DH for Ron Bloomberg doesn't just mean designated hitter, but also designated Hebrew. That was the name of his authorized biography, a code written by Dan Schlossberg. That was back in, I believe, 2006. And Bloomberg actually recently created a book about Thurman Munson. He and Munson, again, coming up through the Yankee farm system at the same time, two completely different personalities, but they meshed well together for the several seasons that they were in New York. It's a book called The Captain and Me. And again, you can find out more about this at his website, ronbloombergyankees.com. And you can also, for a fee, get the autographed copy. And Bloomberg still shows up at old-timers games and also does a lot of scouting throughout Major League Baseball. Now, just a couple days after Bloomberg became the first designated hitter in Major League history, a relief pitcher would blow a save opportunity and, in fact, lose a game to where the Yankees would start the season, getting swept by the Red Sox, going 0-3. That's not the best way to introduce Sparky Lyle into the conversation, but I'm all about wild segues. So Albert Walker, Sparky Lyle, born in Dubois, Pennsylvania, raised in nearby Reynoldsville. He has more of a claim to fame than just that one game in 1973. He was actually drafted by the Baltimore Orioles back in 1964, or signed as a free agent, I should say. And then in the intra-league draft, this was before the amateur draft, later in 1964, the Boston Red Sox would claim him. Now, much like Bloomberg, a multi-sport star in high school, he starred in football, basketball, and would play American Legion baseball because the town that he was living in, it just wasn't big enough. The school wasn't big enough to field a high school team. Now, he had a tryout with the Pittsburgh Pirates in 1964 alongside another Pennsylvania native, Bruce Dalcanton. Well, the Pirates thought that Dalcanton just had better stuff, so they signed Dalcanton, and Dalcanton had a pretty good career. Also, would later become a pitching coach for the Atlanta Braves, would mentor a lot of the up-and-coming young Braves pitchers such as Tom Glavine and John Smoltz, just to name a few. But as for the Sparky Lyle situation, like I said, eventually does sign with Baltimore and gets picked off by the Boston Red Sox. Now, he would move up through their farm system, and after the relief pitcher Dennis Bennett was sold to the New York Mets, Lyle would get called up to Boston, where he would start his major league career. And this was in the day and the age of the beginning of the closer, which was becoming a more defined role, and he certainly stood out in that role over time. and you know, even was able to get a, you know, a few saves here and there, as well as a couple of impressive starts too, with the 67 Red Sox. Now, after the 1971 season, Lyle would be traded to the New York Yankees for Danny Cater and a player to be named later, who would become Mario Guerrero. And of course, over time, it's pretty obvious that the Yankees won that trade there, as he was able to really craft himself as a closer. He would play a big part in the Yankees winning three pennants and two World Series in the late 1970s. Also, racked up some hardware. 35 saves in 1972. He actually finished third in the MVP voting in 1972, believe it or not. He would actually win the Cy Young Award as well in 1977, became the first American League reliever to win the Cy Young Award. So what did the Yankees do? They went out and got Goose Gossage. Yeah, Rich Gossage comes in. He's younger. He's a little more harder throwing than Sparky Lyle. Of course, you got a lefty in Lyle and a righty in Gossage. And as Lyle would share in his book, The Bronx Zoo, which he co-wrote with Peter Golenbach, and it's an outrageous, it's an incredible book. I highly recommend that you read it if you haven't already. The 1978 Yankees were a group of assorted fruits and nuts, much like the 77 team was. But, you know, in addition to kind of having that tell-all story, Lyle was also able to share his frustrations of, you know, being a defending Cy Young Award winner, yet being upstaged by this new acquisition in Goose Gossage. Still, he was able to contribute mostly as a setup guy for Gossage in 1978, but he finally got his dream come true after being left off the postseason roster due to a little medical issue in 1978. He finally got traded to the destination of his choice, the Texas Rangers, where the Yankees traded him along with Mike Heath, Larry McCall, and Dave Rasich for Domingo Juan Beniquez, Mike Griffin, Paul Mirabella, and some guy named Dave Rigetti, who would kind of turn out okay. A couple minor leaguers also going in that deal. Domingo Ramos to the Rangers, Greg Jennison to the Yankees. The Yankees also gave the always cash-hungry Rangers $400,000 in the deal. Now, Lyle wanted to go to the Rangers, but it was not to be. He had a disastrous couple of seasons with the Texas Rangers. He would eventually get traded to the Philadelphia Phillies for a player to be named later, who turned out to be Kevin Socie, a reliever who was a little wild, to say the least. And Lyle would be part of the Phillies during their 1980 successful stretch run, but he did not really play a big part in the Phillies National League Championship Series or World Series. But he did officially become a three-time world champion when the Phillies did defeat the Kansas City Royals in six games. Now, his numbers started to balloon. The Phillies hung on to him for a couple more years, but finally in August of 1982, he was purchased from the Phillies by the Chicago White Sox, and after that season, he would get released and finishes his career at that time, a 16-year career with 238 saves, which would eventually get bypassed by Raleigh Fingers and, ironically, Dave Rigetti in the left-handed saves department. Now, afterwards, he would become the manager of the Somerset Patriots, a position that he held for 14 years, and he is now manager emeritus with that club, an Atlantic League team based in Bridgewater, New Jersey. One final note about the craziness of Sparky Lyle. He was best known for his clubhouse antics, a noted prankster, big with the hot foots. But also, Sparky Lyle had the habit, and he shares this in the Bronx Zoo, of sitting down naked on top of teammates' birthday cakes. Yes, he would leave a nice big ass imprint in the icing of his teammates' birthday cakes, and he stopped doing it because he feared that a teammate would eventually get back by sticking a needle or a pushpin or something in there. He also did all sorts of other interesting practical jokes, and oh, by the way, a teammate did get back at Sparky Lyle for sitting on birthday cakes, as there was a cake that was delivered to Lyle with a big pile of poop on top of it, courtesy of Ron Swoboda. Now you know why the name of the book is The Bronx Zoo. Last but not least, a teammate of Sparky Lyle's in 1980, Tug McGraw. Yes, birth name Frank Edwin McGraw Jr. Why was he called Tug, you may ask? Well, the story goes, his mother, Mabel McKenna, didn't like how the youngster would tug at her breast during breastfeeding. So little Frank McGraw Jr., creating some bad habits early in life, that is how he got the name Tug. You learn something new every day, right? Grew up in the San Francisco area, graduated from St. Vincent Ferrer High School in Vallejo, signed up with junior college in Vallejo, Vallejo Junior College, and would sign as an amateur free agent with the New York Mets in June of 1964. Now, much like fellow teammate or future teammate, I should say, Nolan Ryan and many other ball players at the time, we told you the Tim Johnson story a few weeks ago, he had to serve some military duty. He was a Marine Corps reservist, much to the delight, or I should say not so delight, of his brother, who was a peacenik. So Tug McGraw had to, go through Marine training during the Vietnam War, while his brother Dennis was very much against the war, although it turns out McGraw was a little bit of a dove at the time. Well, once he gets through his reserve duty, and as he starts moving up through the chain with the New York Mets organization, he would, as a starter, make his major league debut in 1964. He actually made the opening day roster coming out of the 1965 spring training. So he starts with the Mets, a very humorous quote to start his career. Somebody asked him what he thought about AstroTurf in Houston. He said, "I don't know. I never smoked AstroTurf," which is probably a good thing. Over time, he would get moved from the starting rotation to the bullpen, mostly because the Mets had some other pretty good pitchers, Jerry Kuzman, Gary Gentry, and some cat named Tom Seaver. That's also why the Mets eventually traded Nolan Ryan, because they couldn't find room for him, and John Matlack was looking to be a little more promising coming up the pipeline. So it wasn't being moved out of town. It was being moved to the bullpen, where McGraw would be part of that 1969 Miracle Mets season, although he didn't play a major role in the Mets World Series victory. He did appear in the NLCS against the Atlanta Braves, but did not appear in a game against the Baltimore Orioles. Now, the legend of Tug McGraw and the New York Mets would be cemented in 1973 as the Mets were struggling midway through the season. Their owner, M. Donald Grant, is in the Mets locker room. He's trying to give the guys a pep talk, and Grant just kept saying over and over, "You gotta believe, you gotta believe." You know, he's just trying to cheer up the guys, right? So Tug McGraw starts playing along with it, and he just starts shouting, "You gotta believe, you gotta believe," and he's really just making fun of M. Donald Grant. Well, word gets out that Tug McGraw is shouting, "You gotta believe," and the rest of the players are going, "Yeah, you gotta believe," and what do you know? That becomes the rallying cry of the Mets making it to the World Series in 1973. Now, ultimately, they would lose the World Series to the Oakland Athletics, who were just a buzzsaw at that time. But as McGraw was a character in the locker room, he was also starting to experience some arm issues, and it would turn out he actually had a cyst in his arm, and the Mets tried to unload him as damaged goods in a trade with the Philadelphia Phillies. McGraw, along with Don Hahn and Dave Schneck, would go to the Phillies for Del Unser, John Stearns, and Max Scherce. The Phillies doctors discover the cyst, they pull it out, and what do you know? McGraw is back to normal and becomes a pretty reliable pitcher in the Phillies bullpen throughout the late 1970s. He had a very adventurous 1980 season, especially in the playoffs, where he actually blew the save in the championship determining game five of that year against the Houston Astros, but the Phillies would win in extra innings. And then in the 1980 World Series against Kansas City, he would, McGraw would get Willie Wilson to strike out in game six, and legendary film footage of him, you know, jumping up and down, arms in the air, getting carried off. And it's a legendary moment in Phillies history for a long time. The only bright spot that they were able to share, and that World Series in 1980, the first for the Phillies in their club history, which dated all the way back 97 years at that point in time. Now, after the 1980 season, he would stick around with the Phillies, and as he got older and a little less effective, the Phillies decided to move on by picking up Al Holland, a former closer with the San Francisco Giants, and coming to the age of 40, McGraw decided to hang it up following the 1984 season. So he would finish up with a tremendous career, like I said, 1965 through 1984, so 20 seasons overall, two-time All-Star, two-time World Champion, and is also part of the Hall of Fame for the Mets and the Wall of Fame for the Phillies. Now, you may know a little bit about Tug McGraw's son, a son that Tug McGraw did not acknowledge for the first 17 years of his son's life. That would be one Tim McGraw. Yes, the country singer is the son, dare I say the illegitimate son, of Tug McGraw. Now, he had a brief fling with a young lady in New Orleans by the name of Betty D'Agostino. This was back when McGraw was playing for the Jacksonville Suns in the minor leagues. And even though they reportedly only had an affair, just a one-night thing, she got pregnant. She gives birth to Tim McGraw. Now, you got to think about this. In, you know, Louisiana, 1966, you know, unwed mother who was very young at the time. I think she was in her late teen years. You know, that's something that is not taken lightly. And in fact, Betty D'Agostino was shipped away to live with other family members because the family was kind of ashamed of what was going on here. Thankfully, she gives birth to Tim and he grows up and finally touches base with Tug McGraw in the mid-80s. And they had a very, very solid bond. And when Tug McGraw was diagnosed with glioblastoma in 2003, while the prognosis at first was good, it would turn out to not be good in the long run. In fact, he would pass away just a little over 9 months later. Well, at this time, Tim McGraw is working on a song that wasn't written by him. It was actually written by Tim Nichols and Craig Wiseman called Live Like You Were Dying. And because this happens at the same time that Tug McGraw is dying from brain cancer and ultimately dies in January 2004, the song and the music video were inspired by Tug's life. And in fact, that video footage of Tug McGraw jumping up and down at the end of the 1980 World Series featured prominently in the music video. Number one country song of 2004 by Billboard magazine. It was a number one song for 7 weeks. And I could still hear the song. I can hear that hook in my head. It's a very well-written, well-performed song. Did Tug McGraw help the Phillies win one more World Series? Perhaps. After McGraw died, he was cremated. And right before Game 3 of the 2008 World Series between the Phillies and the Tampa Bay Rays, Tim McGraw would spread a few of Tug McGraw's ashes on the pitcher's mound. The Phillies would hang on for the win there, 5-4 in the victory, and they would win that World Series. What seemed to be weeks later, there was a very lengthy rain delay, but I believe it was in 6 games in that series. Now, Tug McGraw's legacy continues. Following his death, the Tug McGraw Foundation was established to enhance the quality of life of children and adults with brain tumors, and the program was extended to cover post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. And there's a lot of work with the military, especially with PTSD and TBI as well. So they're all connected, believe it or not. Ron Bloomberg, who was a teammate of Sparky Lyles, who was later a teammate of Tug McGraw, and who were all featured in the 1972 Topps set. I hope you get a chance to check out 72 Topps. You can find some bargain bin beauties for those cards. But also check out, if you can find it, the Topps Heritage cards, which pay tribute to the 1972 Topps set. My thanks again to our guest today, Nick Deonte. Again, a great friend of the program and a friend of mine as well. We really appreciate his time. Again, if you want to get to learn a little more about Nick and some of the things that he writes about and talks about, baseballhappenings.net is the website, and you can follow him on Twitter at examinebaseball. That's all one word. And I think you'll enjoy the articles he writes and a lot of the commentary that he has. Now, I hope that you'll like our next podcast. Again, it's coming your way 2 weeks from today. That will be Friday, April the 9th. We'll be taking a look at the foodstuff cards, all of the co-op co-sponsors of cards created throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s featuring food products or restaurants. You've got some pretty interesting ones that were made during that time. Don't forget, wait in line for your vaccination. Let's keep those COVID numbers coming down, the vaccinations going up. I actually got word earlier this week I can finally get my shot next week, so I'll be looking forward to doing that. But in the meantime, continue, please, take care of yourself and others, wear your mask, stay socially distanced, and wash your hands. Folks, we're almost to the finish line here, or at least in a much safer spot than we were just a year ago. So please take care of others. And if you want to be selfish, take care of yourself and wash those hands, wear that mask, stay socially distanced, get that vaccine, help yourself, help others, and let's get back to normal, hopefully this summer, as we'll be getting back to baseball here in just a few days. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.